Thank you, Mr. Meese. I was almost hoping he was going to announce me for the closing prayer. I told Randy he should be scheduled for more split sermons. I was still trying to write notes for my slides, and his sermon was almost as short as some of his sermonettes. We've been giving each other a hard time. We were trying to figure out who was going to go first today, and I told him age before beauty, and then I told him he probably wins on that account too, so he's got some things going for him, at least. All right, so this is my inaugural split sermon, and hopefully it goes well. If I go as long as I have slides for, I'll definitely make up for time, and we may be here till 12:30. But I'll try not to go that slow. So we're continuing on with the series of A House Built by God. Today is part 5. I actually went back and counted all my parts now, so I know where I'm at. So today I want to start talking about building on solid ground. I actually had 3 points I was going to cover in this message, but as I got into it and started studying, I think I have enough material I could do a couple more sermonettes or maybe another split sermon after this, if this one doesn't bomb. So when you're building a house, there's 3 important things that you need to consider. Any realtor will tell you it's location, location, location. If you want to turn over to Matthew 7:24, or read up on the screen, it says, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock." So Jesus sets the example right here, that we need to be founded on the rock. And Jesus also follows what he says. So he would want to build on something solid, not just give the advice to other people. So where did Jesus choose to build? If you look at Matthew 16:13, it says, "When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi." Did he build his church in Caesarea Philippi? Caesarea Philippi is known by that name as well as 22 other names. I'm not going to read all these because I can't pronounce them all. But some of them, Mr. Ashley told me that the Arabics don't pronounce P's in their alphabet, so they would be Banyas, even if it's pronounced Panyas. And those are the Arabic names for Caesarea Philippi. And a lot of these are named either after Caesar's son, who was Philip, or after the god of Pan, or the god of Pan. So there's a lot of names brought up here. So why would or wouldn't God settle his church and establish his church in Caesarea Philippi? If we read a little bit more about Caesarea Philippi, it's 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, so about from where we're standing right now or sitting, to the center of Longmont, and at the base of Mount Hermon. Caesarea Philippi is the location of one of the largest springs feeding the Jordan River. The rains fall on Mount Hermon and seep through the limestone and then flow out of the bottom of the mountain and start the headwaters of the Jordan River, I found out while I was researching this. The abundant water supply is very fertile, and it's attractive for religious worship. And then numerous temples were built in that city of the Hellenistic and Roman periods, and they still existed at Jesus' time. If you look at this map, I couldn't zoom it in. I'm still trying to learn how to use PowerPoint, right? But at the very top of that map, there's a little note that says Mount Hermon right there, and then just down to the right at the headwaters of one of the tributaries, it says Caesarea Philippi. Shows where it was in the region. Further down, it's not on this map, but I'll point it out here in a little bit. This is an artist's rendition of what Caesarea Philippi looked like, with the pagan temples and the Mount Hermon cliff behind it. This was a cesspool of paganism and evil worship. Zoom in a little bit further on this. You can see the legend on the left side. The building on the left was the temple of Augustus, I believe. I thought these had numbers on them that I couldn't kids see now. But oh, yes, down at the middle. Number one was the temple of Augustus on the left side of the screen. And then clear over on the right side was the temple of Pan and the dancing goats. Mr. Ashley informed me of some of the things that they did there. I'm not going to mention them because that's not the point of the sermon. But this was just, like I said, a cesspool of evil and debauchery and not a place where you would think that God would want to be. But he still went there to prove a point and to make a point. And we want to come back to this in a little bit. But this was what it looked like where they went to at Caesarea Philippi. Just all kinds of pagan worship and debauchery and the exact opposite of where you would think that you'd want to build a house. There's a couple of plaques of the gods that they worshiped there. I'm sure you've heard of having a nemesis. Nemesis was the goddess of vengeance and Roman imperial justice. Her long and narrow court was built in 178 CE in front of a great niche in which her statue was placed. A Greek inscription above the niche mentions the names of the goddess and of the donor. The pavers of the court were arranged in a checker pattern of white and reddish stones. And I really like playing chess, so I hope that's where they didn't get the idea for it. Then we had the sanctuary of Pan. This one's a little harder to read. I wonder if I can zoom in on this. No, I can't. The conquest of Alexander the Great in the 3rd C BCE brought the Greeks to the east and to Banias. The Greeks were taken by the natural beauty of the site, touched particularly by the cave in which the springs welled. It is no wonder that they sanctified this cave, dedicating it to Pan, the god of forest and the shepherds. Thus came the name Panias, later becoming Banias in Arabic pronunciation. Towards the end of the 1st century BC, the Romans incorporated Banias into Herod's empire. To show his esteem, Herod built a temple near the Banias Springs and named it for the Roman Emperor Augustus, Herod's son Philippus, established the seat of his rule here, calling the town Caesarea Philippi. However, the name Panias continued on, and Banias it remains until this day. The sanctuary is located on an elevated terrace above the Banias Springs, enclosed on three sides by cliff walls. And we'll come back to the cliff walls in a little bit. The Pan Cave was special due to the deep natural chasm in the floor, which led to groundwater. Animal sacrifices were thrown into the chasm. During the Roman period, beginning from the 1st century BCE, temples with statues, including the Temple of Augustus, as well as rock-carved niches and Greek inscriptions appeared. These indicated worship to other gods in addition to Pan. The sanctuary continued its pagan activity well into the age of Christianity in the Byzantine era, but in time, the temples near the cave were neglected or ruined. The date and circumstances of the sanctuary's destruction are not known. The archaeological excavation conducted here by the Israel Antiquities Authority under the direction of Dr. Z exposed the remains of temples and courts, sculptures, altars, and inscriptions. These findings indicate the performance of sacrificial rites and the bringing of offerings, mostly food, ceramic and glass vessels, altars, and statuettes, to Pan and the nymphs, as well as to the other Greek gods such as Zeus, Athena, Hera, Aphrodite, Artemis, Dionysus, and Ares. And I know I butchered some of those names. At the eastern end of the sanctuary, near the sacred forest, two structures associated with a unique cult of dancing goats were exposed. One was their place of exhibition, the other their burial site. According to Panias City coins, at the foot of the sanctuary, there was a sacred pool of semicircular shape surrounded by a colonnade where spring water was collected. The pool served as a congregation place for worshipers and the location for the annual Pan Festival. The integration of sacred architecture in the scenery of springs, mountain forest, and natural cave found here is singular to the Near East and perhaps in the entire Greco-Roman world. Then there was the court of the nymphs, of Pan and the nymphs, and I won't read all of that one, but through my research and everything on this sermon, I found that The pan is where we get panic from, as well as pandemonium. And I wonder, I didn't research on this, but whether or not pandemic comes from that same Greek god. So that doesn't sound like a really good place for God to build his church. So what about Mount Hermon? Hermon is up at the top of the map again there. And this map does not show where Jerusalem is down to the south, but it's about 152 miles from Caesarea Philippi down to Jerusalem and where Mount Zion is, which is about from here going up to just south of Wheatland, Wyoming, if you wanted to walk that far. This is Mount Hermon from the distance. It's the tallest mountain in the nation of Israel and in that whole region. It's visible from over 60 kilometers or 60 miles away. I don't remember which. But if you think about the Front Range of Colorado, it's like seeing the Rocky Mountains come up on the horizon as you're driving west from Kansas. You start seeing the mountains over the horizon, and you can see the whole Front Range from Pikes Peak to Long's Peak. That's what Mount Hermon is for Israel. Mr. Lockwood gave a sermon once about how Colorado and Israel are laid out similarly. We would be on the west side of the mountain range in Israel versus the east side, but it's a north-south corridor, and it's very similar to our topography as far as seeing the mountain ranges off in the distance from our valley. So it's got a very similar landscape as far as that goes. The arid dryness and everything is kind of similar, but they have different vegetation, obviously. And this is actually covered in snow for two-thirds of the year, and they have a ski resort on this mountain as well. So there's a little more detail about Hermon, Mount Hermon. It's on the southern tip of the Anti-Lebanon mountain range. Its peak is at 9,230 feet, so not as high as our mountains, but it's still pretty significant, especially in that region when it's the tallest one. As I said, it's the highest point inside of Israel's borders, and Israel's highest point today that they have control over is 7,295 feet. Mount Hermon is also known as Baal Hermon, named after the god Baal. Senir, which is mentioned in the Bible in various places. Sirion, Sion, and by Josephus is Mount Lebanon. There are more than 20 ancient temples that have been found on the mountain and in its vicinity. So even Mount Hermon was a place of pagan worship and all the things that I mentioned before. Still doesn't sound like a place that God would want to start his church and build his house. But it wasn't all negative. In the Bible, Psalms 133, verse 3, in the New Living in the NIV, says, "It is as the dew of Hermon were falling on Mount Zion." And in Song of Solomon 4, verse 8, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride, descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards." So before it was full of debauchery, or after Israel had cleaned it of all the people that had lived there before, the Amorites and everyone else that they drove out of the country, Mount Hermon was looked up to in more ways than one. It was written about in poems, in the Psalms, in Song of Solomon. So what is Mount Hermon's status today? As I mentioned, its summit is at 9,232 feet. The United Nations has a buffer zone between Syria and the Israeli-occupied territories. It's the highest permanently manned UN position in the world, known as Hermon Hotel. The southern slopes of Mount Hermon extend to the Israeli-occupied portion of the Golan Heights, where the Mount Hermon ski resort is located with a top elevation of 6,690 feet. There's a peak in that area that rises to 7,336 feet and is the highest elevation in the Israeli-controlled territory today. Jesus didn't build his church in Caesarea Philippi or on Mount Hermon, but did he use them as the PowerPoint of his day? We don't have the ability to go to Israel and see these things, and we have modern technology to show slides. But in Jesus' day, he could walk around and point right here behind him and say, "This is the example that I want to give you." like us using the Front Range with things that we're familiar with. Jesus was a walking PowerPoint presentation. He went all over Israel and used the examples of his day to illustrate what he was trying to get across. Caesarea Philippi and Mount Hermon played very significantly into the words that Jesus had to say after they got into the region of Caesarea Philippi. So we continue on. If God didn't build his church there, did he build it on Peter? I learned a few things in the last week. I don't know why I did this. I've been in the church nearly my whole life, but I was talking to Mr. Ashley about this, about Jesus building the church on Peter, and he's like, actually, that's not how that happened. So I had to do some more research on this. So Matthew 16, verses 13 through 18, starting in verse 13, it says, when Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, as we read earlier, he asked his disciples, saying, Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And I read also that the Son of Man refers to just a common man. The Son of Man says, who do they say that the common man is? So they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And I found this significant as well. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. This is the first time that's recorded that anyone referred to Jesus as the Son of God. He had revealed himself to the Samaritan woman at the well and told her that he was the Messiah, which was also significant. If you remember Mr. Ashley's sermon about that, she was a Gentile and she was a woman, which was just looked down on in the Israelitish and Jewish communities. But this is the first time that's recorded that anyone told Jesus that he was the Son of God. And Jesus acknowledged that Peter was, that was revealed to Peter by God the Father himself. He didn't just figure it out. And then he said, and I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And that's where we get confused with Jesus saying that he would build the church on Peter. But let's look into that scripture a little bit more. Peter is Petros, and rock is Petra. So what is the rock? And Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church. So what was this rock? Was it Caesarea Philippi? Was it Mount Hermon? Or was it something else? Peter, or Petros, equals pebble, or a small stone. Whereas rock, in this translation, is Petra, a big rock, or huge boulder. If you think back to the pictures that I showed you of Caesarea Philippi and the temples there, that was a huge cliff face that rose way up above the temple and everything else. It was a huge rock, a boulder. It was a great illustration of what Jesus was talking about. And it was so big that you couldn't see Mount Hermon behind it because it dwarfed over the top of the city. So everybody got the illustration that he was talking about in that time. It's like going to Red Rocks. If I said go to Red Rocks, everyone sees the massive red rock pointing up, jutting up at an angle. I've never been to Red Rocks, but I've seen tons of pictures of it. I know I'm a native and I've never been up there, but I've driven by and I see the Hog's Back and everything else. Everyone would get that visualization of being a huge rock or a massive boulder. And it wasn't just any rock. This rock would prevail against the gate of Hades. Also, the gates, I learned, are defensive, not offensive. So this church is an offense. It's on the offensive. It's not just stagnant, just sitting there. And the temple of Augustus and the house of Pan, people referred to it as the gate of Hades. They worshiped the devil there and thought that that was the entrance to hell or to Hades. So when Jesus said, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, he was poignantly pointing out Caesarea Philippi and all the evil and debauchery right there. that once his church was established and his foundation laid, that the gates of Hades would fail. They would not be able to resist the offensive that God would put up against it. So who is the rock? It's not Dwayne Johnson, and I never did smell what he was cooking. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 4 tells us, "And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." Also Psalms 95, verse 1, "O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation." Deuteronomy 32, verses 3 and 4, "For I proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. Righteousness and upright is he." Also in Psalm 18, verses 1 and 2, "I will love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold." I read through that chapter. It's like 52 verses last night. I wanted to include it, but I didn't think I had enough time. So God is our rock. Jesus is our rock. We know that. It's pointed out in multiple verses besides the ones that I just read. So we need to build on the rock. But do we just believe in the rock? Can we just say, yeah, I believe that Jesus is the rock, and go from there? We've heard the warnings. I'm not going to get into the building on the sand, because today I'm talking about the rock. But it takes more than just believing in the rock and not doing anything. It takes effort. In Luke 6, verses 47 and 48, he reads, "Whoever comes to me and hears my sayings and does them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently against that house and could not shake it, for it was founded on the rock." So we see here that it takes effort. You have to dig deep. You have to put down roots into the rock. You have to attach to it. Before you can even lay the foundation, you have to dig down and really understand that rock and want to be involved with it. You want to be anchored to it. Thankfully, I work in construction, and we've built on a rock before. This is up in Red Feather Lakes. That's a full-size Ford pickup on the top left picture, and the equipment that we rented was the biggest thing we could get to try to dig through all this granite rock that we encountered on this job site. You can see the hill on the top right corner and the bottom left corner as we started digging. This was after the blaster had already come and dynamited. He didn't use dynamite. He used some other explosive that I can't remember now. He had drilled over 400 holes in this already and blasted into it. The bottom right picture is when he came back to do some more because we still didn't have enough rock out of the way for us to lay our foundation. So I've got a couple of videos here now that kind of illustrates what kind of effort it takes to attach to the rock. We'll see if they play. Hopefully we have a little bit better. Make a nice point with it. Well, that's new. I ran through this in the practice last night and I did not have this problem. All right, let's see if this works. An excavator named John Henry. Anyone who's familiar with history knows who John Henry was. Kind of ironic they named a piece of equipment after that guy, but they drilled over 400 holes with this piece of equipment before this day, and they had to come back and drill 20 or 30 more in order for us to get the parameters we needed for our foundation to be dug. This was from several feet away, and it was still pretty loud and almost deafening. They had to do this 9 to 10 feet deep, hole after hole. It took them 2 weeks to drill the first 400 holes, and it took them 2 days to drill the other 20 that we had to put in after that. Then, after they had drilled all the holes, they filled the holes with explosives. I wonder if I have this saved where I can get to it quickly. I want the audio. Oh, really? Oh, yes, it is. All right, let's try this again. When this blast goes off. But this was after days and days of blasting and digging and equipment breaking down. The machines are hiding off to the side so they didn't get hit by shrapnel and flying rocks from the blast. To get to this point. And we have heavy equipment and technology that they didn't have in Jesus' day, and we're digging into granite, which is one of the hardest materials on earth. Watch the bottom part of the screen there. You're going to see a rock blow out from underneath. It comes out here to the bottom left part of the screen. That rock was about the size of a basketball and blew it about 65 to 70 feet across that open chasm of rock that we had dug through for days and weeks, probably 2 weeks already. And then took hours of preparation. You can go set that down, Sam. You see the dust settle there? Oh, I want to show you another thing real quick. Watch that big rock at the top to the right of the pads. That rock weighed about 8 tons. So as you can see, it takes a great deal of effort to dig into the rock, to dig down and to set roots to where you want to build. So it's not just a passive relationship between us and the rock. We have to really dig down. We have to want to be there. We started this job, and the GC on the project showed up, and he's like, oh, you guys can just dig down in there. It'll just slough right off. It does it all the time. And my brother Jeff was looking at it, and he's like, I don't think we're going to dig down into this one. So he took a machine and sat down, and hang on a second, stop video playing in the background. So we dug into it, hit, and it was solid. So the GC's like, let me get up there and try it. He's like, you guys don't know how to dig this off. So He jumped up there and boom, shook the whole machine. It was a little bit smaller than the one that we ended up with. He goes, I guess we're going to have to blast. So they called in the blaster. He's certified in the state, travels all over and blasts into the sides of mountains where he needs to. And this was solid granite. He said he didn't find a more than maybe a crevice here or there that he didn't have to drill through. Everything had to be blasted. He said it was one of the hardest parts of Colorado he had ever found to have to drill into and to blast out for us. And he had used multiple charges, hundreds of charges. He said it was incredibly hard to dig. And that was just to get us to this point where we could start laying the foundation. So it takes a great deal of effort to get to this point, just to the point where we can start laying our foundation with the rock. So in conclusion, God didn't build his foundation and start his church in a physical place, but he started it on himself. Jesus is our rock that we are building this house on. He is what we are attaching ourselves to. And this isn't a passive attachment. We're not just sitting on the rock. We're not just believing in the rock. We're having to dig down. We have to study, understand, and to put into practice the things that we hear. Otherwise, we have no attachment. And when the winds blow and the floods come, we will be washed off the rock. It's not just about sand washing away. It's also about us not being attached. When my dad died 17 years ago, everybody said I was strong, but it wasn't me. I believed in the Bible and I believed in what God says. Over the last year and a half or 2 years, we've had a lot of loss in this congregation. And we all have to remember that we're still attached to the rock, and that is solid for all of us. It's not us that have the strength. It's our belief in God and what he teaches to us, that we will see our loved ones again, and that whatever comes before us between now and God's kingdom, he's got our back. If we stay attached to him and solid in our belief with what he will do for us, and we don't lose that grip on our rock, we will be part of that house, and it will prevail, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against this rock.